Track This Thread, Chapter 5. Warning, this chapter contains pretty graphic body horror. 3 days later, Stark sends everybody a text. Avengers, do that alliterative thing in the 50th floor kitchen. Clint feels like he floats there, doesn't remember the trip in from Brooklyn or the elevator up from street level. When the door slide opens sky high in the tower, it's to a wild-eyed Tony Stark, wearing a lead bib, orange Crocs, his hair pinned back by a polka-dot headband, and saying, "Barton? What the fuck is that?" Lucky, taking offense, backs up further into the elevator and barks at Tony the way he barks at lapdogs, with deep suspicion. "We were on a walk," Clint says, because he'd been suffering the silent catatonia of long-term tension, still frantically and tiredly turning over the possibilities in his head, watching Lucky take the world's most elaborative shit. Then the text had come. None of his neighbors were in, and who the fuck knew how long this was going to take? So because Clint is both a shitty and good pet owner, he'd stuffed himself and Lucky into a car and drove wildly, wildly dangerous into the city. Tony narrows his eyes. Why does he have an eye patch? Lucky has an eye patch because Kate Bishop is ridiculous and spending way too much time on some website about crafting. It's purple because at least she respects Clint's wishes in some small, meaningless ways. What did you guys find out? Clint asks, because he genuinely doesn't know why Lucky has an eye patch. Only that he'd passed out on the couch yesterday watching a This Old House marathon on PBS and woken up this morning to Pizza Dog, Virgin Pirate. And then the fat bastard had been ultra-attached to the thing and whined and shook his head out of Clint's hands over and over again every time Clint tried to give the dog back its dignity. So, fuck it. They'd gone out like that. He'd been complimented by 4 people in skinny jeans and 2 guys with elaborate facial hair by the end of his block. Fucking gentrification. Tony gives Lucky one last lingering look of suspicion before saying, "Stuff. Things. It's complicated." Clint has a vivid, intense flashback to the time he'd been loitering around Fury's office door, waiting to get his ass chewed out, and overhearing Coulson calling from Malibu to say he was going to shoot Stark in both his knees. Thank God Steve sticks his head around a corner right then and says, "Hey, pirate dog!" Which is just so annoyingly endearing that it prevents Clint from acting on the reflex of doing stuff Coulson wants and beating Tony senseless. It takes another 10 minutes before Natasha rolls in, clutching a carton of assorted Baked by Melissa cupcakes. Her expression makes it clear she's in no mood to share, but Clint is an asshole, so he just watches Steve and Bruce play with Lucky, who is in raptures. Equal odds on if it's because he's a dumbass or just everybody loves Steve, while Tony figures that shit out by himself. "Enough shenanigans," Tony says finally, clutching at his rapidly bruising hand and glaring at Nat. "I brought you all here to tell you important, potentially life-changing." Bruce, who is rapidly becoming Clint's favorite Avenger, just sighs and does something to a tablet, and the whole wall behind Tony's head turns into a monitor again. Screens and screens of diagram and files and... "My God," Steve whispers, and Lucky presses close, whining. This time, when Tony talks, he's quieter, grim. Some of those pages that you guys brought back that we thought were gibberish, they were just coded, and they resolved into images of, well, that you see here. Clint is intimately familiar with gore, the rubbed penny smell of blood, and the hot musk of someone's insides on the outside. He knows the body and all the ways you can rip and rend it. But in his Merc days, those were Mercs. And in his S.H.I.E.L.D. days, those were bad guys. Or, at least, he was just a weapon aimed by someone making the least of all possible mistakes. Clint's broken a lot of bones and woken up in a lot of hospitals, and he's not scared of them the way other people are. Medical is where you go once your backup comes in, once you hit a safe house, once Coulson's found you where you were bleeding out in the dense jungle, rationing your energy for breathing. He's burst in on backroom mob surgeries and field-treated compound fractures, held filthy palms over thigh wounds, felt femoral arteries bleeding out. But this is different. This is a man's chest cracked open. There's rib spreaders in place, but it's more for show than anything, because the ribs are a fucking mess, bone shattered. And beneath the surgical lights is a brutal mess of shredded organs. There's the pulpy sponge of lung and the torn muscle of heart, blood welling up, metal instruments clamping off who the fuck knows what. Clint can't tell where one broken thing ends and another begins. And he can't stop staring at the fringes of the picture. There are green and blue surgical scrubs and gloved hands, but they hover around the frame of a dress shirt, cut through, soaked in ruby port blood, a tie tossed out of the way, the edges of a single-breasted suit, the black sticky and drenched through. Nat talks first. She says, "That's not survivable." "That's just the first picture," Tony says, grim. The next five pictures are just the same fucking shit show. And Clint is about to ask what the fucking point of calling them here just to make him look at Coulson ripped to pieces is. Wouldn't it have been better just to call and say, "He's definitely dead. You can keep mourning like an unacknowledged widow now." When Bruce says, "This is where it gets weird." Clint stares at him. Thankfully, Steve says it for them all when he asks, "Weird?" Banner gets that reflexive wince, that tick in his eye, and he scrubs the heel of his hand into the arch of his brow line and waves at the wall, where one excruciatingly scarlet photo turns into something different altogether as he mutters, "Weird." "The date stamp on this implies some time has passed," Stark says, calling up a window with streams of metadata, image encoding information, dates, times. Clint doesn't care about any of that, because this is still Coulson. Only his eyes are closed peacefully in a parody of sleep. Or it looks like sleep, most of his body covered up with a blue surgical cloth. There's fucking frost on his eyebrows. Is he asleep?" Clint asks, and it comes out first with a click in his throat. "No," Stark says. "From the file info, it looks like this image was taken 8 days after the first set of pictures." Bruce, quietly, says, "There's no heart-lung perfusion system attached. There's every indication he's dead in this photograph." "You said this got weird," Natasha cuts in, brisk, the way she's always brisk when people die on her watch, when she's turning off non-essential systems so she can bear through something, the way she bears through everything. "Dead is not weird." "The next chunk is missing, timeline-wise," Stark answers, and makes a sweeping motion with his hand to bring up another file. "This one, straight gibberish. We can't seem to crack this one. It's not code, and it's not any language we know. In the order of the files you brought back, we can assume it's chronologically between the earlier stuff and, well, this." The next file is a video. It's Coulson again, the same sleep-smooth face and the blue surgical drop cloth. But there's a steady beeping noise in the room now, the murmur of voices in the background. There's the occasional hand whipping in front of the camera. And then he hears, "Fucking Jesus." Then he hears Dr. Stuyten say, "Any neurological response?" And someone else, someone Clint doesn't recognize, say, "No, nothing." "He's dead! What are they doing?" Steve asks, finally, 2 more minutes into the video, which is so fucking unsettling. Just a steady shot of Coulson's face and someone saying, "Mark, Mark, Mark," at seemingly randomized time intervals. I took the liberty of pulling a background sound profile from the footage and compared it with audio from all known medical machinery. Jarvis chimes in from overhead, doing nothing really to alleviate the tension. In front of Clint's face, someone's gloved hand presses on the skin of Coulson's pale cheek, moves to push up the lid, and Clint has to smash his eyes shut before he sees the dead blue there, fogged over. From my analysis, there's a 98% chance that we have at least two separate machines running, a heart-lung perfusion system, as well as an intracranial pressure monitor. Jarvis continues, bloodless. Unfortunately, the angle of the video makes it impossible to verify the types of surgical procedures being done. Bruce says, "We're pretty sure this is a surgical monitoring video, nothing for a permanent file, but maybe something surgical assistants were watching in another room." "What were they watching for is what I want to know," Natasha murmurs, standing to get a closer look at the video, narrowing her eyes. "He's pinker in this." "Pinker?" Steve repeats, skeptical. Clint pushes up out of his seat and goes to stand over Natasha's shoulder as she says, "Coulson put both of us on Captain America Thaw Watch. I know when someone's defrosting." And Tony says, "Oh my God! Were there no limits to how man-crushy his man-crush on you was?" And Clint just reaches out like he can touch the image that's hovering in front of his face, run his fingers over the cold planes of Coulson's face. "What are they doing to him?" Clint asks, and he doesn't realize he's asked it until he's listening to the silence that comes after. He swallows hard and asks, "I mean, if he's dead, if they had him on ice, what are they doing to him?" Banner clears his throat. "Our best guess is they're reviving him." Pause. "Somehow." Clint turns to stare at Tony, to stare at Bruce, who both have the flat, tired expressions of people who have already looked at this problem for a long time. And Steve, where he's tense on the edge of the sofa, looks lost, staring as the video keeps running near soundless behind Clint. "After at least, what, 8 days of him being dead?" Clint asks. His voice doesn't sound like his own. It sounds far away from him. "How is that possible?" He doesn't ask, "What are they even bringing back?" "It's fury," Tony says, like that explains everything. Then Steve snaps, "Pause the video." And when Clint turns back, is to see the telltale metal and amber architecture of a piece of Chitauri technology at the corner of the image. Just a snatch of the segmented body of a piece of armor. The very definition of alien against the bland hospital blue. Officially, Nick Fury is Phil Coulson's boss. In the pseudo-military parlance of S.H.I.E.L.D., Coulson and Hill are his XOs. Unofficially, in the bone and blood and mud of Brotherhood, Fury and Coulson are the type of dicks that became best friends at Ranger School. So off the clock, they are the fucking worse. Clint says this having grown up with circus people. Natasha says this having grown up in the Red Room. If you get Sitwell drunk enough, he'll tell you a horrifying old-school story about the infancy of Fury and Coulson's S.H.I.E.L.D. tenure that involves literally 40 rubber dongs and a dare about a car battery and testicles. I guess if you have rolled around in puke and piss-filled mud together for days, you don't mind sharing experiences that involve rubber dongs, a car battery, and each other's testicles, Sitwell had said, sounding sad about his professional choices. Coulson has keys to Fury's apartment, which is fucking weird, Because until Clint had stolen Coulson's key ring for funsies that one endless op in Mozambique, Clint had just assumed Fury attached himself to one of the pull-up bars in the gym and slept in bat form. One time, when Coulson had succumbed to one of those immortal flus that live inside the ventilation systems of all New York office buildings, swear to God, Clint saw Fury bring Coulson a quart of soup from the Second Avenue Deli. In the years Clint shared radio lines and op tents and mess halls with those two bastards, he's heard Fury say, "Sweetheart, you kiss your mother with that mouth?" And Coulson say, "No, asshole, I saved that shit for yours." People like them, like Clint, like Natasha, they don't make friends a lot, not the kind you give your house keys to and make your mom jokes with, and who have probably electrocuted your nuts in some sort of fucking crazy person military bonding ritual. So yeah, Tony's right. It's Fury, and it's Coulson. Nat and Steve were in the file rooms at White Plains for a sum total of 34 minutes, and got out by the skin of their teeth between two patrols. The files they brought back aren't comprehensive, but the rest of the stuff they managed to sift through is stomach-churning and implies more of the same. Coulson was dead, and then maybe he wasn't. That they'd cut him open again and thawed him out, stuffed him full of Chitauri technology. They know that there's a blacker-than-black ops team involved now, existence paper only. And through the process of elimination and insider information, they've narrowed the potential members to just a handful of people who are OTOO. "Off-tracking on ops," Natasha tells Stark, because at this point, the guy's balls deep into S.H.I.E.L.D.'s computerized guts and knows the organizational shorthand for weird bribe, and it's pointless to be coy about it. It's for when you're in the field, but, for security reasons, not on the grid. Tony stares at the ops list. That's like 100 people right now. "Excluding Wetworks," Clint says. "Wetworks is never on any grids. Wetworks is an extraordinarily successful Arby's in New Mexico." "Which," Tony points at him, "believe me, we will talk about Wetworks later, but excluding a more specialized assassination squad, that is like 100 people. Nat hums and slants a look at Clint. She asks, "Six?" "Higher," Clint disagrees. "Minimum 7. 34, Tony interrupts, mullish. "Purple. Banana hammock." "Jarvis," Natasha says, ignoring him. "Can you remove all agents on the list who are clearance level 6 and below?" The list of names and IDs drops from more than 100 to less than 10. Clint and Natasha say, "Not Blake," immediately, because the 2 months Blake and Coulson had shared an office wall had been terrible for literally everybody at S.H.I.E.L.D. If they were trapped on an op together, people would know from the flaming wreckage and body count by now. "Not sit well," Nat says. "We saw him at HQ this week." "Maybe sit well," Clint disagrees, because Sitwell is the best liar in all of S.H.I.E.L.D. Sitwell's mom legitimately thinks he's an orthodontist. "Field team, stealth jet. Unlikely he's basebound," Steve cuts in. And standing up to get a better look at the names and designations, he says, "Is it likely that science and technology folk this high up on the clearance list are mobile?" Natasha nods approvingly. "Good catch. Usually they run various tech sites. Jarvis?" Two more names disappear. Darby and Slanger, who co-manage the sandbox. And that leaves just a few potentials. Yang, Soleimani, Ward. "May," Natasha says. "They were at the academy together." Melinda May and Coulson worked together during the Jurassic period, before Fury was director. One time, she snapped in Coulson's ear, and he fucking flinched away from her. And for that, and other equally compelling reasons, Clint never knows whether to shit himself or pop a boner around her. She's not on any other duty rosters, Stark chimes in, typing rapidly. Before she went on your dumb 002 list, she was doing some kind of paper pushing. Clint glances at Natasha. It could be her, I guess. If I was making an even more classified SHIELD team, I'd want the cavalry, Nat says, mild. At which point, Steve adds, and it looks from her file she knows how to fly that stealth jet we found records for. Every time you say stealth jet, Tony cuts in, I just hear, challenge accepted. Okay, Bruce interrupts, holding his hands out like the daycare workers at SHIELD sometimes do when they're trying to settle clusters of spy toddlers in the Midtown lobby, each of them low-jacked to the gills. Before we start hunting down, he pauses, making a pained face. Terrifying stealth jets that SHIELD will surely have us killed for knowing about. What is the end game here? Nat glares at him. The end game is to figure out what happened, Banner. Yeah, but wouldn't they have told you if you were supposed to know? Banner asks. I mean, listen. I've registered my deep and profound distrust of SHIELD and Fury in the past, and that hasn't changed. But say Coulson's alive. Say they did some fucked up shit to him, stuck some Chitauri tech in his guts. Clint digs the nails of his fingers into the meat of his palms, fists his hands so hard his knuckles hurt. Because the thought of filling up the good, human spaces inside Coulson with something not makes him sick. He'd never agree to it. He has an ironclad DNR filed with his attorney and at home in his desk. And if this is true, is he? Is it still Coulson? Why hasn't he looked you guys up? Bruce goes on. You're his guys, right? Maybe he's compromised, Natasha snaps. And Clint's glad that when she gets pissed, she gets verbal. Because when he's this hurt, his throat just closes up. Maybe he's hurt and doesn't know how to get in touch with us. Or maybe he doesn't want to be found, Bruce proposes. Clint's not sure if he forgets, or just that he hasn't had a lot of time to think about it. But this weird little survivalist group of shifting allegiances that's gathered in the living room of Stark's giant penis tower? Clint forgets they don't get it. Not yet. Stark is crazy and lonely and bought all of his friends retail. And in a fucking terrible and sad way, maybe he'll never really believe that the people who like him actually like him. Because when it all began, it was randomized pay raises for Pepper and experimental jets for Rhodey, bottle service for that chauffeur of his. He hasn't even learned after the bullshit and torture and self-sacrifice. Because he more or less stole Bruce Banner off a New York street and stuck him in some sort of nerd cloister in the tower, directly adjacent to the multiple floors of superhero harem he built with archery ranges and epically useless shoe closets. And Rogers might be all about brotherhood and go army, but he's got the most impressive case of repressed PTSD Clint's ever read about that he's not supposed to have read about. Literally, what the fuck is there to say about Bruce Banner, who did super soldier experiments on himself, fucked up real bad, and would 100% prefer to be in some shit-stained refugee camp than New York, which he mostly associates with that time he decimated a giant chunk of Harlem. Maybe Bruce is right. Maybe Coulson doesn't want anything to fucking do with them. Maybe he's hidden away on purpose. Used a scalpel on top of blunt instruments to remove himself, and every, almost every, Clint thinks, trace. Maybe he wants to never see Clint and Natasha again, wanted to put miles of daylight and time zones between the people he knew and the life he'd carved out. But what the rest of the assholes in this room don't get is that Coulson doesn't get to make that call. Right now, SHIELD doesn't like Clint a lot, but in the years and years and millions of miles that Clint has traveled, they have been the net waiting for him under the tightrope. They've been the shitty siblings and the tyrannical parents, every fucking first cousin and uncle and aunt, a sprawling, awful shitshow of a family. They were in his business and trafficked in embarrassing Clint Barton stories. S.H.I.E.L.D. is not necessarily the good guys, but they aren't the bad guys in comparison. They are circumscribed inside a fortress of complicated alliances and Machiavellian choices. They are comfortingly, reliably terrible mac and cheese and bad coffee and agency-issued cots that smell the same everywhere you go. They are the champions of interagency kickball 6 years running, because when you play versus the CIA and NSA, cheating and espionage beginning up to 2 months prior to the game is practically required. S.H.I.E.L.D. is where Clint grew up, and Coulson is who made sure he lived to see it. To Stark and Banner, and maybe even Rogers, the system is obscure directives without explanation, to be considered with suspicion and ignored at will. To Clint, to Nat, the system is trusting Sitwell to brief them, Coulson to watch over them in the field, Hill to establish the infrastructure, and Fury not to spend them cheaply, even if they've agreed to let him chamber them. If Coulson is alive, if he's shuddering in and out breaths, or if he's lying in a hospital bed with machines forcing that into his lungs, then Clint and Nat are coming for him. It doesn't matter if he doesn't want them there. If he wants to run, he's forever responsible for the people he's tamed. If Coulson wants to go far away, then Natasha and Clint will go far away with him. We'll decide if we care what Coulson wants once we've figured out if he's alive, Natasha says, matter of fact. For now, what we need for you to do is to get us to that jet. Stark looks rapturous. Roger says, I'm calling Miss Potts. Pepper, for all that she's the voice of relative reason, is voluntarily fucking Tony Stark on the regular, so Stephen Bruce really shouldn't have relied too heavily on her being a tempering influence on this entire debacle in progress. She has one of her secretaries send Captain America to voicemail, which, weird. And then when she calls back an hour later, she sounds only pretend mad. The way Sitwell gets pretend mad when he finds Clint teaching the baby agents how to create extemporaneous weapons out of shit they find in the supply cabinets and S.H.I.E.L.D. mess. Well, clearly Stark Industries can't appear to have anything to do with this, she says. And Bruce looks so momentarily hopeful that it's almost sad when she adds, which is fine, since I doubt S.H.I.E.L.D. wants to disclose to anybody that we were able to so easily locate their stealth jet. Yeah, Pep, it's not like we really need your permission here, Stark cuts in, trying to appear as if he's not waiting for her permission. Of course, Tony, she allows, rolling her eyes, and says, go for it. You don't own me, Stark quips, fairly vibrating with excitement. I do what I want. This time, Pepper turns to Natasha. I'll file a flight plan with the FAA for Singapore and buy the appropriate carbon offsets. It won't buy you a lot of time once you get within their range. We'll make it work, Natasha says. Appreciate it, Miss Potts. Pepper looks directly at Clint, smiling. Anytime. And good luck, Clint. Okay, Clint chokes out, feeling flustered, and all of 14. Fuck, this is worse than 14. Clint was a smooth operator at 14. Finding the stealth jet takes hours and hours, during which Stark is furious and spends a lot of time banging around the guts of his computer, yelling at Jarvis for disappointing him, and getting snotty comments back from their house computer about stage parenting. Clint spends most of this time training until his arms are shaking and taking Lucky out for 1 million walks. He's a big hit with the Midtown corporate lunch crowd. By the time he gets back to the tower, he finds Steve, Natasha, and Bruce watching Say Yes to the Dress, Bridesmaids, with a combined terrifying intensity. "Are you being serious with me right now?" Clint asks them. Lucky, the traitor, just woofs and gallops over to flop on Natasha's lap, rolling onto his back so she can rub her hands all over his belly. Somehow maintaining her dignity through all of this, Natasha says, "Stark has it narrowed down a little." Steve makes a snorting noise. Clint likes Captain America a lot better now that he knows Steve Rogers is a comforting, regular human jerk sometimes. Specifically, he said it's somewhere in Asia, Bruce clarifies. "But that was 2 hours ago," Steve adds, "and given that it's a plane..." Which is how Clint ends up watching Say Yes to the Dress, Bridesmaids, too, sitting through two objectively terrible episodes before Stark hollers,
"Fucking eat it, assholes! I fucking have you! That's right, Daddy's coming, you... Yeah, you just park there, you hot piece of stealth plane ass."
They interrupt before it gets any more disturbing. In the circus, you learned a little of everything. Nobody could shoot the way Clint did, but Billy and Cyrus both could do a little, and if they stripped down the act and moved the targets a few feet closer, you could muddle through on days when Clint was down with the flu. Same went for Sarah and Jesse subbing for tumblers with sprained ankles. And Missy May was almost as good as Jed when it came to juggling, even if the big clown shoes didn't fit her right. Clint had hung around the trapeze guys. He liked the heights. Right on page one of his SHIELD Psych abstract is a note in Dr. Sorian's boxy handwriting, making a note of Clint's problematic thrill-seeking tendencies, having reached a level of competence in the face of controlled danger that drives Specialist Barton to seek out deadly and extremely high-risk circumstances. This shit started young. Started when Clint used to hang from the trapeze bars by his creaky teenage knees and stared down, miles down, pendulous and heavy in the head and shoulders, feeling gravity drag at him and lose when Clint would launch off, sail weightless through the air. So when Stark's backup unregistered plane, what the fuck, catches up to the stealth jet and finds it midway through a launch sequence, Clint doesn't think. He doesn't think about how long it will take to find the jet again if they lose it, how SHIELD is good at learning from its mistakes, and that this might be their only chance. He doesn't think about the ulcerating mass of guilt and hurt that's been throbbing in his gut now for months. He doesn't think. He just moves, the way he used to just let go of the trapeze bars. What's the point of Stark's jet descending to land the same time the stealth jet is steaming up the same stretch of runway in some god-awful game of plain chicken, if not to let Clint open the cargo release and jump? He lands on the fucking nose of the stealth jet with a bone-crunching clatter, feet skidding for purchase and all the wind knocked out of him. Just a pair of vibranium knives anchoring him to the sheet metal skin. The wind is whipping at his face, and the nose is like an oncoming train. And Clint can't even tell if the pilot is slowing down. Fuck SHIELD and its active recruitment of borderline sociopaths anyway. But the plane does slow, eventually, the wind giving way to the other noises of the airstrip, the sound of people yelling at Clint in the distance. And when Clint can lift his head and unclench his white-knuckle grip a little from the knives, it's to look up and see Melinda fucking May glowering at him through the windshield of the jet.